You are listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource, and we are grateful to all of our listeners who help keep us the podcast going by donating to the show. We are also grateful and proud to be supported by the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies.
Hello, and welcome back to the Talking About Organizations podcast. Today we'll be talking about the work of the Aston Group, and we are joined by Bob Heinings, one of the original members of the team. And this is Pedro, calling from a sunny day in Lyon, in France.
This is Greta, calling from her urban jungle in Oxford.
Hi, this is Tom, calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in the United States.
And this is Bob Heinings, calling from Okotoks, Alberta, just outside of Calgary and with the Rocky Mountains in view.
So let's start maybe with an overview of what is the Aston Group. You know, we use this designation for a group of organizational researchers working between 1961 and 1970 under the leadership of Derek Pugh. Members of the group originated in different areas of research, such as psychology, economics, political science, and sociology, and included John Child, David Hickson, Bob Heinings, Diana Feasey, Charles Macmillan, and Lex Donaldson. The group was based at the Birmingham College of Advanced Technology, renamed to Aston University in 1966. The Aston studies consisted of a series of comparative studies to produce broad insights into the relationship among organizational structure elements and with the context. One of their main insights was the discovery of the distinctive configurations and varieties of organizational structure, expanding both our knowledge on this theme and also the way in which we think and study organizations. Their work has an important character also in the development of the contingency theory and has an influence still in current scholarship, such as in the study of organizational structures' effects in a variety of phenomena, such as innovation, learning, entrepreneurship. Our conversation today will be structured around the papers published at the Administrative Science Quarterly from the Aston Group. It would be a bit different than our usual episodes, since we have the author with us. We'll be not only looking at the insights from these publications, but also trying to go beyond and understand the backstory and the overall research program that underpin this work. So maybe we can start by asking Bob to give us a bit more of a glimpse on what was the word of the Aston Group, you know, what looked like and where it came from.
Yes. I mean, one of the things to remember is, I can go into a bit of history, I think, here, can't I? I think one of the things to remember, of course, is that in the early the 60s, organization theory in both North America and in Europe was a very, very small group of people. It was just beginning to emerge from the sociology of organizations. And the concern, of course, for pretty well all scholars in those days was the notion of bureaucracy and the whole post-war economic expansion and the rise of the continuing rise of the very, very large organization. But the actual title of the research grant under which we operated was, surprisingly, worker behavior under different incentive systems. So that was what we got money for studying. Because of the guy who was officially the leader, a guy called Tom Lupton, who was a social anthropologist from the University of Manchester, but he became the chair of a very, very large department at Birmingham College of 55 people. And didn't have any time for the research. And he had done work on basically what in those days in Europe was known as restriction of output by worker groups, organizing their own production systems. But we quickly decided, the group of us, that in order to understand worker behavior in groups, you had to understand the organization in which that was set. And of course, then you had to understand why the organization was shaped like it did. So from early on, the idea was that this was a very large program of work that would look at organization structures, the context that produced different kinds of structures, the structure of groups within those organizations, and then individual behavior, because we saw these as all linked. Now, I said it was a small field in those days. Two of the people who we knew personally who came and talked to us about this were Tom Burns and Joan Woodward. And Joan, when we described what we were doing to Joan, she said, but that's about 25, 30 years of work, when we described the whole thing. And we just nodded our heads and said, sure, what else would you do? Well, of course, it never really came about, as we all went in different directions. So we were a very unusual group as well, in that we were all quite young. Derek Pugh, I think, was 29 or 30 when we started. So we were in our 20s and early 30s. Derek was trained as an experimental psychologist originally. David Hickson came into academia in a very strange way, having been the assistant secretary of the Bristol Stock Exchange. And that was accepted as a degree qualification. And he did a master's degree, again, on restriction of output in a worker group. Then myself, I was the kind of one sociologist, true sociologist among them, having been trained at Leeds and the London School of Economics. And so I suppose I was the one that initially brought the ideas of Weber and bureaucracy, although, I mean, everybody saw that as the starting point. So I think one of the key things is that we were a very mixed group, which led to, I think, a lot of innovation. We're a group that, through Derek Pugh, who was very much the guy who had more experience than the rest of us, that was committed to programs of research. And I think the other thing is that being at the Birmingham College of Advanced Technology, which didn't even award undergraduate degrees at that time, nobody quite knew what we were doing and just left us alone to get on with it. So we had, and we were joined after a year by Chris Turner, who was actually, his initial degree was in geography and his PhD was a community study of a remote village in the English Pennines. Nobody kind of understood what we were doing and said, okay, you can just get on with it. And so none of us, there were four of us, full-time researchers who taught one course a year each. Now, I think it's important to get that, because those kind of setups hardly ever occur these days, where you can put those kinds of resources into the study. So that would be some of my first comments. I mean, I could say a lot more about the studies, but I want to ask really at this point, Pedro and the rest of you, I mean, do you want me to say any more about the studies themselves per se?
I think you do, but let's hear from the others what they are thinking.
Cool. Yes, I would love to. Go ahead and present the different articles. I think that's a great way to continue.
Okay. Well, as I said, I mean, the obvious starting point in thinking about organizations in the early 60s was to talk about bureaucracy, because that's what the literature in the sociology of organizations was about, whether it was a literature that was about the structure of bureaucracies, or whether it was, if you like, a a literature, I would just say somewhat more critical literature, but a literature that essentially said, well, bureaucracies don't operate as they're supposed to. Monographs like Blau's Dynamics of Bureaucracy and Gouldner's Patterns of Industrial Bureaucracy and Merton's whole group. In fact, again, just an aside, one of the very interesting things about showing the how youthful the study of organizations was in the 50s and 60s. Peter Blau's book, The Dynamics of Bureaucracy, Philip Selznick's book, TVA and the Grassroots, Alvin Gouldner's book, Patterns of Industrial Bureaucracy, were all their PhD theses under Robert Merton primarily. And so, you know, this was an exploding field, with the centerpiece being Weber's work on bureaucracy. So that's where we're going to start. But this is one of the areas where, if you like, theoretically, conceptually, I think it's fair to say I made a, you know, a reasonable contribution because I was the one trained sociologist, although I'd never done a course in the sociology of organizations per se, but I'd done an incredible amount of study of Weber. So that was, if you like, one of my major contributions was in some of that initial formulation. But Derek Pugh was very much the one who said, we have to do this very systematically, and we have to give a strong comparative basis to the research. So the first paper, the 1963 paper, kind of outlined the literature on bureaucracy, and then what we took out of that, outlining the major dimensions of organizations, of specialization, standardization, formalization, centralization, decentralization, and some others, which we eventually found we couldn't actually deal with and measure. But that lay, and then the what we called then the contextual variables, scale, ownership, etc., that would impact organizations to produce different kinds of organizational forms. So that was kind of laying out the basis. Then the analysis, I think, again, there are some very important points that I don't know whether you, whether you looked at Weber, of course you have. But when you look at that, one of the things that's really interesting to me is when you look at the methodology section in the 68 and 269 papers, it's really incredibly short. And it doesn't, I mean, in many ways, it doesn't tell you a lot. It tells you quite a bit about the statistical analysis. It doesn't tell you very much about data collection and who we interviewed, and so on. Today, of course, that's all much longer. In not being as long, I think it misses out a couple of things that are really very, very important, I think, in understanding the research. The first is that it was all the data. And you will know from the 68 paper and the 69 papers that there was an incredible amount of statistical analysis. I think, again, as an aside, the Aston studies were the first studies to use psychometric scaling for organizational data, the first studies to use regression analysis in a major way, the first studies to use principal components analysis. But all of that data was collected through semi-structured and later very structured interviews. I wasn't sure whether this was going to be, a video or not, but I have sitting here on my desk the interview schedule, which runs to about 70 pages. In these early days, we were qualitative researchers who turned it into quantitative material. So we have this interview schedule, which, when we went into an organization, take something like Cadbury's, for example, which was one of them. The first thing we did was interview the chief executive. Well, actually, that's not true. The first thing we did was a factory tour to understand what this organization did and how it did it. Secondly, we interviewed the chief executive, get an overview of the organization. And then we interviewed the marketing people, the production people, the planning people, the strategy people, the research and development people, etc., etc. So in an organization like Cadbury's, we probably interviewed about 25 people. So I was doing a quick calculation, 46 organizations in the random sample, 52 organizations looked at. We did probably around about 500 interviews. None of that, of course, is in any of the papers. And then as good, you know, good qualitative researchers, but who were on a path to quantitative analysis, I have another document, which is called the writing up schedule. So we had the interview schedule, and then we wrote up the material according to the concepts, such as specialization, standardization. We, in other words, we analyzed the interviews into a set of categories, and then we actually brought to bear statistical analysis. And I think a lot of people assume that the kind of data we collected, we must have gone out with a questionnaire or something like that, you know, and got people to fill it in. No, we collected all the data. We analyzed all the data, and then we took the step to turn that into quantitative data. Now, of course, that was, all of that was very, very much the influence of Derek Pugh and his training. None of us had the kind of quantitative training that Derek had. But I think it's a really important point to say this data was collected face-to-face through interviews, which we then analyzed, just in the way, in many ways, that qualitative researchers would do today, putting it into categories, etc. We then took a step, because in fact we had a lot of it, because there were four people full-time for 4 years, you know, we could actually look at 46 organizations. Perhaps one other thing. So 46 organizations in the 1960s was a very large sample, which of course today it wouldn't be for a quantitative researcher. So what we wanted, the three things that we wanted initially to do were, first of all, systematically analyze the notion of organization structure. That was where the paper Dimensions of Organization Structure came in. And you'll see in that paper that we utilized various scaling techniques and principal components analysis and so on to actually show that we could demonstrate the specialization, standardization, formalization, centralization, decentralization were stable dimensions. Actually, I think, and I didn't go back and look, there's an aside probably about centralization, decentralization saying, well, it wasn't as stable statistically as the other dimensions, but it will do. And in fact, in any subsequent research, I think that dimension has been the most unstable. It's the most difficult to deal with and measure. So we were then able to show how these dimensions related to each other, that they were stable, that they related to each other. The second thing that we wanted to do, which is the heart of the context of organization structure, was to show what was it that caused differences in organization. Again, a starting point for us was that there will be systematic differences between organizations that we need to explain. And of course, one of the major explanations that had grown up this point was technology, both through, I mean, particularly in Britain, through Joan Woodward's work, which again, as an aside, it's interesting that Joan's classic little booklet work was actually done at something called the Southeast Essex Technical College, a non-degree granting institution. And one of the great things about those kinds of institutions like Aston, as I've said, is that nobody understood what you're doing, so they let you just get on with it. So technology was one. Another thing, of course, that comes out of the literature very strongly is size. But nobody had ever systematically looked at how these kinds of things impacted organizational structure. We, of course, in the Aston Studies, in many ways became known as the people who said it was all about size. Well, we didn't say it was all about size, but we said that that was very important. And for us, in our sample at least, technology was important, but subsidiary to size. So that was where, of course, the use of regression analysis came in. And in terms of statistical analysis, we got some very, very high R squares. The third paper, it's interesting actually. The third paper is one that I really like. And maybe that's because I fought for it. Derek in particular was not interested in taxonomies or typologies. He was interested in variants. And I argued that because we were coming out of the bureaucracy literature in particular, for example, because of things like Goldner's notion of the punishment-centered bureaucracy, representative bureaucracy, and mock bureaucracy, that, you know, we actually needed to take this data, this material, and turn it into, see what we could do about a taxonomy. And I think that was very important because it did, I think, two things. It showed that there are potentially different kinds of bureaucracy, what we called a personnel bureaucracy and a workflow bureaucracy, and a full bureaucracy. And the only organization that we called a full bureaucracy was one that was both a public sector organization and a manufacturing organization. And then there were non-bureaucracies, more simple structures or implicit structures. So to me, that was a very important paper, although it is actually the least cited, the most heavily cited paper, and it's up at about 3,000 sites, and it still gets cited every year, is the Dimensions paper. The second most cited is the Context paper, and the Empirical Taxonomy is the third most cited. And then, of course, what we wanted to do was go on and take that taxonomy and look and say, how does this impact the internal workings of the organization, the groups, the individual behavior? Now, by that time, I was onto other things, and so were other members of the team, but there was a stream of research that came out in the 70s, the early 70s, that actually did try and look at individual and group behavior. David Hitchens was involved in that. A guy called Roy Payne was involved in that. And Kurt Inks. But that we always think of as second generation Aston.
Thanks, Bob. That was super interesting to hear a bit about the background of these papers. And I did was very impressed by the methodology section. And indeed, I saw that it was based on interviews, and one thing you didn't mention was that they also were semi-structured. And in that sense, like this set of studies, as you said, it was kind of the beginning of the field of org studies in Europe, and it started with mixed methods. It's you know, really using interview techniques and doing really advanced analysis with it. And I appreciated that a lot, and you know, the tremendous amount of work that went into it, thinking through the setup of the study, thinking through how to approach the analysis, how to scope out different papers. There are so many things we can learn from these papers.
So I think my first question is, what did you get? What happened with the founder? You know, were they happy with the, before we talk about the whole content, I was curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, the granting body was something called the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, a government body, which was actually the predecessor to the, well, what now is the Economic and, what's it called? ESRC, Economic and Social Research Council in Britain. But anyway, but again, we come back to the small nature of the field. The Secretary General of DSIR was a guy called Albert Cherns, who was an occupational psychologist who later became a professor at Loughborough. And he just came and visited because Derek knew him very well. And, you know, he came and chatted with us about the research and several times, and he kind of said, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I like what you're doing. I mean, it was very much along the lines of, if you're doing interesting work, I will continue to support it. Not, here's what you said you were going to do, but you're not doing it. What's happening? You know. Again, it comes back, there was Albert, yes, Secretary General of DSIR, but he probably had a staff of about 5 people. So, I think one of the things, and we are, you know, we're talking nearly 60 years ago now, aren't we? It was a very, very different world. Very different world indeed. You know, so, and you could do almost anything, and it was new. Unlike, I think, you know, like Tom, Greta, Pedro, Demetrius, what you face is, gee, there's this vast literature. Where am I going to enter it? You know, whereas I was in a position of, well, there's this small literature and what? There's so much to do.
Which kind of leads me to a question. Do you tend to see a lot of, new ideas that are actually kind of old ideas that are just being updated with new terms? Or are we repeating the same conversations in this larger scope of literature? They're basically revisiting the old questions as opposed to really breaking new ground?
So I think that's a yes and no. I mean, I think there is a certain, I read stuff, these are Royston Greenwood and I and Renata Meyer published a piece in AMR, I can't even remember, 4 years ago. I'm at that stage in my life where everything happened 5 years ago until I look at it and find out it was 15 years ago. But it was a piece, it was called Dusty Books, The Liability of Oldness. And it was an essay that Jean Bartunek basically commissioned, in which we re-reviewed TVA, Burns and Stalker, and Lawrence and Lorsch, and said some of the things we said. Look, there's material here that is incredibly relevant today. There are things we don't need to reinvent. For example, people will talk about differentiation and integration, which Lawrence and Lorsch talked about, in a different way. They should go back. And they should recognize that when Lawrence and Lorsch talked about differentiation and integration, not only did they talk about it structurally, they also talked about it perceptually. They talked about things like time orientation and so on. So, yes, I think there is, I've heard one North American professor say, I tell my students it's really not worthwhile reading anything that was published before 2000. So I think there is.
Oh my God.
But on the other hand, no, the field is full of tremendously interesting new stuff. I mean, I only have to look at my own career, and the way that it's moved. Although I would always say that at the heart of it is still an interest in organization form, organization design, organization structure, and differences. So, yeah, I think there is a great deal worthwhile in these older studies in getting to grips with them and seeing what they actually said. Because that's the other thing that happens, you know. The Aston studies still get referenced, cited. But actually, if you look at the citations, they're what I would call honorific citations. You know, if you actually have a sentence or a paragraph which is about the analysis of organization structure, you reference the Aston 1968 paper. Doesn't mean say you're using it at all. You're just showing, rightly, as a good academic, that you know the stuff. You know. So I think as one gets older, one sees two things, Tom. One is, yes, I think we said that, although sometimes when I go back and look, I think, oh, no, perhaps we didn't say it. But, yeah, I think we said that, and I think people need to know that. But the other is to say, no, this is a wonderful field with lots and lots of things. The one thing that I do, and maybe we'll get around to this a bit later, the one thing I do think is missing in much organization theory is the kind of comparative analysis that the Aston studies and Burns and Stalker and Woodward and Howard Aldrich and so on show, which is, you know, reasonably sized samples where you actually know a lot about the organizations, as against either very, very, very good single or maybe two or three case studies, or data sources where you've not collected the data and where you can have a sample or a population almost of hundreds sometimes of organizations, but you actually know very little about the organizations. I think one of the things that the Aston studies represented was, and Greta put it very well, you know, of a mixed method study, is actually we understood and knew the organizations that we're studying. And I can say that in my career, I have never, ever analyzed any data for a study where I did not take part in collecting the data. All of the data, the samples and so on that I've used are ones where I understand the data, where it came from, what it means. And so if I, for example, use statistical analysis, I can say, I don't believe that relationship because that organization is not like that. And I can go back and look. I think that's something that is missing in a lot of current organization. We've lost the strong comparative element.
This is very interesting. And I think, as you said, it's a point that is, it's almost between the text, you know, and you're not familiar with the Aston group through interviews or, you know, reading carefully, I think you miss. And I think it has also at least two epistemological consequences. One, as you said, is one in which you understand what that data means, and you can, you know, it almost is a kind of grounded theory kind of thing, but done through statistical methods in which you're really trying to build from what exists out there. And, you know, but the other thing that I think is important is that, especially when you study organizational structure, or more generally, you know, bureaucracy in general, it's important to be sure, and I remember that the papers talk about that what you talk about in terms of formalization, standardization, is representative of the organization that is being studied. You know, it is when you try to make an overall claim about what this organization is like, it's important to both be able to be precise and say where and how it is formalized. And I think the fact that you described, and you can see indirectly in the way the measures are built, that you have measures for, you know, the different departments, whether it has to do with the workflow or not. You know, you can see that you're trying to map the entirety of the different areas to be representative when you abstract up, you know, to find this kind of common denominator.
Yes, Bob, having the chance to talk to you, I have two questions. And the first one is, if you can tell a bit about, you know, how did you select the companies that participated in its study? And how did you get that access to really conduct these huge amounts of interviews within your organization, as it takes a lot of time from the members? And the second one is, if you can tell a little bit about how you have kind of from your point of view, how the ideas that are developed in this set of papers have been picked up in the field and how others have built upon it.
Okay, the first one, the sample, it was actually a stratified random sample. We started off with you know, the government's list of organizations. We took a bottom limit of 250 employees. So the organization had to employ 250 people. And in fact, the largest organization that we looked at was the British Motor Corporation, which at that time, not very far away from where I lived in Birmingham, had the largest manufacturing plant factory in Europe. There was the Longbridge automobile plant, which employed just over 25,000 people on the one site. So we got from the government records a list of all the organizations in the Birmingham area that employed 250 or more people. And then we stratified them by, you know, automobiles, automobile related products. Because again, one of the things that changed Birmingham in the 1960s and 70s, 50s, of course, was the manufacturing capital of Britain. It no longer is. So a lot of different manufacturing firms, and then public sector as well, so that we had the education department of the Birmingham City Council, and we had a public sector company that manufactured telephones. So we stratified it by size groups and by product category. And we sampled within that, and we were very successful. And again, how did we get access? We got access because this is where being where we were was very important. Birmingham College of Advanced Technology was embedded in the local economy. It'd been around since, Matthew Bolton, the big figure in Birmingham Industrial Revolution. It had been an important part of the education of both artisans and managers and so on. And so the contacts of other people, the department chair and so on, were just wonderful. And so we could send out a cover letter. And we had, it was either two or three organizations that said no. And we were able to replace them. So, I mean, is that being in that particular place was very important in gaining us access. As for example, I mean, you're at Oxford, and I have this visiting appointment at Cambridge. Being at Oxford in Cambridge is often a pretty good place to be if you want access to organizations, whereas being at the University of Central Alberta or something is not necessarily a good place. Not that there's such a university. Sorry, Greta, what was your second question?
Thanks, Bob. My second question was if you can tell a bit about how you see that the ideas from these studies have been picked up and evolved in the scholarship that happened afterwards.
I think, first of all, there was an ongoing concern of empirical studies using the Aston studies in a very direct way. Pedro at the beginning mentioned John Child. I mean, John published 2-3 papers in ASQ in the early 70s, which were direct follow-ups. And in fact, you may or may not know, Pedro does know, because there are in fact 4 volumes of collected papers on the Aston studies. The first volume is of the original papers. The second volume is called the Aston Studies Extensions and Replications. And so those are papers that were published in the 70s, basically, that use the Aston Studies in a very direct way. There's a third volume which takes the wider concern and is about the Aston Studies organization structure and organizational behavior, which is Derek Pugh and Roy Payne. And then there's a fourth volume, which is David Hickson and Charlie McMillan, which is cross-national studies using the Aston Studies. So they were taken up by people in Poland and in India and in Iran. And I did some work with an Egyptian student at Birmingham University on public enterprises there. So that's one part. The second part, excuse me, is I think that particularly, I mean, the Dimensions paper is the most cited. Those ideas of specialization, standardization, formalization, and centralization, decentralization became kind of embedded in the literature as a way of studying organization structure, and I think continued strongly until, of course, by maybe the 1980s, you could say nobody was interested in organization structure anymore, per se. And people had kind of forgotten that one of the, as probably we had on the Aston Studies, that, you know, one of the original formulations that we need to understand this, we need to understand how organizations are structured, because we should always look at that whenever we look at something else. Now, we don't, of course. But, you know, take something contemporary where, you know, so many of my colleagues at Alberta are working. Institutional logics. So if you're looking at an organization and you're saying that there are these two or three different logics at work, the rationale of the Aston Studies would be, well, in looking at that, you need to know what kind of organization they're embedded in and how this is the same or different from other kinds of organizations. That part of the Aston Studies, I don't think, has ever been really taken forward. And so I think we have lost our concern with essentially comparative study, that there are differences between organizations based on how they are organized. And then there is, of course, the movement. Somebody like Jerry Davis would be part of this, and I've argued with Jerry about this, that anyway, bureaucracy is dead. Formal organization is dead. We're in the age of new kinds of organizations. I don't find that argument too convincing working in a large university. I see bureaucracy everywhere, positively and negatively.
Amen to that.
But I knew you would agree.
I have to, well, I don't know if I should do a narrow question here or a broad thing that I was thinking, because one narrow point, but maybe we can talk later, is the difference between bureaucracy and organizational structure or form organization. Because it's interesting, I think, when you read the papers one after the other, and we talked, you know, you presented the progression of the studies, it's really clear that it came from Max Weber and an understanding of bureaucracy, and, you know, the dimensions came from there. It was kind of an effort to make that more systematic and empirical, you know, create dimensions that could be measured and studied and so on and so forth, and then discover how actually there are different possibilities of configurations, not just the one that Weber envisioned, because, you know, different things have different weights sometimes. So different types of bureaucracy come about. But when I see the progression of the papers, you know, I think that the first one, the conceptual work, is very much drinking from that origins. The one on dimensions becomes very much about organizational structure. And then the one on the taxonomies brings back the concept. So I always, you know, it's an endless conversation, and I happen to be working exactly on that, on trying to understand the history of the term and what happened. So I was obviously curious, even though it's a narrow point, on what is your take on this differentiation? Or maybe it's just similar, synonymous for you.
No, it's not synonymous. That's a really good point, Pedro. I think the starting point was bureaucracy, because that's where the conversation is. And in the sense that we think about any of our own work, we start our work from a place where there is a conversation about what is important. The conversation through the 50s and to when we started on the Aston studies was about bureaucracy. It was about whether, you know, the whole thing about, well, did Weber get it right? Bureaucracies are inefficient, etc. You know, whereas Weber, of course, had a very specific notion of bureaucracy and even called it technically the most efficient form of organization ever invented. So that was the starting point. But as in with any conversation, as you work, you move hopefully into new insights. So yes, it then became the analysis of organization structure and form. So that in the taxonomy, as you say, we return to it. We also, I mean, not only do we distinguish between different kinds of bureaucracies, but we start to say that there are organizations which are not bureaucratic, which, of course, is a bit like Tom Burns's argument about mechanistic and organic organizations. And then when I carried this work forward with Royce and Greenwood, I mean, when we first started working together, we utilized the Aston dimensions to analyze as a baseline for change in local authority structures in Britain in the 70s, we were talking just about organization structure, not about bureaucracy, but just differences. And in fact, we published a book called Patterns of Management in Local Government, which had a little bit of bureaucracy in it, which was essentially about organization structure. And I think that's the way the conversation went forward. I mean, if you take your own work and Portugay and Senior and so on, it's quite difficult these days to resurrect the concept of bureaucracy, because we're all past that, aren't we?
We are not. We just don't realize how much we are swimming in it. And I think this is important because, sorry, I don't want to hijack the conversation, but I think is that we have come to see bureaucracy as only the skeleton of organizing. And progressively, even though the Aston have shown us that bureaucracy can have different configurations, you know, it can be very formal in the procedures, but very low on hierarchy or vice versa. It's something that seems to have been forgotten, because I think that if you think about the comparison with Burns and Stoker, I think that idea of mechanistic is much more popular, and it tends to be almost, even though like that book, you know, was never intended in such a way, but there is kind of this bias that the mechanistic is the bad one because it's now it is rigid and blah, 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 blah. All these ideas became attached to it.
Yeah, this sort of strikes a chord with me because, of course, I'm working in the public sector, so I'm surrounded by bureaucracy. And of course, I get that sense that whenever we use that term, it's used in the pejorative. So when I hear somebody say that formal organization is dead, my usual response or my initial interpretation of that statement is like wishful thinking, seeing all of the bad stuff and say that we should get rid of it. So if we keep saying that it's dead, then maybe people will believe it's dead and it will go away. It won't anytime soon, at least not in my world. But I do wonder, you know, in a lot of ways, like when we talk about structure, because the term structure is itself a bit loaded, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And it's sort of changed over time. I mean, when I see the dimensions of structure as they're described in the series of papers, there's some differences, and it's hard for me to put my finger on it, but I sense some sort of differences in terms of what you were talking about structure in this series of studies versus how some people use the term structure nowadays. And I wonder if you sense that, or if you think that, perhaps the conversation's gotten a little bit confused because of the evolution of the way we use the term structure.
Interesting and tough question, Tom. Yeah, I mean, I think it's right for things to evolve. I mean, we shouldn't, in one sense, be using 60 years later all the same concepts that we used in the 50s and 60s. We clearly see that developing. And when there was a kind of an outbreak, I was going to call it, of a concern with organizational form in the 90s, when the conversation started about new organizational forms. And I think when you start talking about new organizational forms, then you maybe need to think, maybe you can start again with the conversation about specialization, say, but you need to rethink that, because when you just people were then starting to talk about new organizational forms, they were talking about flexibilities. They were talking about different kinds of relationships between organizational groups or departments. They were talking about different kinds of boundaries people started to talk about boundary spanners. So I think as the phenomena change, we actually have to say, do our concepts still apply? If they do, which bits still apply? Because if we believe and if we can show that organizations, certain kinds of organizations, are quite different. So if we take to use some very contemporary examples, if we take a Spotify, is that organized differently? Now, as I've dipped my toe into that water, again, I find that people actually don't ask the question, how are Spotify's and Airbnb's and so on organized? Because there are so much more interesting things about platforms. So I think we can ask the question and we need to, but yes, we have to be open to our conceptual structures and our conceptual arguments, the actual arguments, changing.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. You may not know this, but we really love receiving feedback from our listeners. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some of the best people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Riener, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Karamustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Pix Kraft, Timothy Paul, Willy Lechton-Wirta, and Gabriel Van Bonnen. And I apologize if I mispronounced your name. You are still the best and we love you so much. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website where a donations button will greet you. You can't miss it. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time for part 2 of the episode here on Talking About Organizations.